Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program. She's with us this hour to talk about recent events and to look back on and take stock of 2021, as well as looking ahead a little bit to 2022. And we have a lot of topics to cover, so let's get to it. Welcome back, Mayor Lyles. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good morning to all of our listeners. And can I say happy holidays? I know that we all celebrate differently, and I want to wish everyone in our community, everyone in our city and our region, happy holidays.
Well, let's begin then with the present or recent past and then review 2021. Last week, Vice President Kamala Harris and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg were in town to talk about the recently signed infrastructure bill and to talk a bit about President Biden's Build Back Better bill, widening the social safety net. The two spoke at a cats maintenance facility, very glamorous. We have ambitious transit plans in Charlotte, and it appears that the administration is on board with that. Here's the Vice President.
With our bipartisan infrastructure law, we will make the largest ever investment in public transit in our nation's history. North Carolina alone will receive $910 million for public transit over the next 5 years. And for here in Charlotte, Mayor, well, you are doing extraordinary work, upgrading your bus system with more connections, more frequent service, and more electric buses. And I know that the funding that we are delivering will help.
Well, you may be doing it right now, but CATS is hoping to spend $13.5 billion to expand the transit system. How much money might Charlotte get from this infrastructure bill?
Well, you know, the federal government has all kinds of formulas. If you remember when we started on our first line in the south part of our track on the blue line, they were funding 75% of those kinds of improvements. That has dropped down to 50%. And what our legislative actions are would be to go to the federal, to the USDOT and say, can you do more then? Because the shift in the burden to the local communities, as opposed to building a great federal system that we should have assistance for, that's where we're kind of focused. So we're really thinking, can you increase the proportion of funding that you give us? We may not get to, you know, 75%, but certainly if we could get to more than where we are right now, that would be very helpful.
Is the Charlotte Gateway Station part of the CATS improvements of the transportation plan, or is it separate from that?
You know, it's a combination, Mike. When you look at the transit center that we built, and it at the time it was just a model because it allowed us to have a place where our bus system could operate. Our bus riders would have amenities. Besides, if you remember the old Eckerd's on the square where you kind of had to stand, and if it rained, you were right. You just got soaked. But the transit center, we believe, can be a little bit better, higher utilization. It can be both an economic development opportunity as well as an improvement for our transit riders. And so it's a combination of both. We did get from the federal funding $15 million to invest into that site. And we are beginning to make plans and work through the economic development. How do we leverage that $15 million so that we get not just a transit center that's fabulous and provides the amenities that we need, where we can actually circulate our buses without having the traffic congestion that we have now, and then figure out how to get some of that money back on the tax, some of that property back on the tax rolls.
That transit center, that will move the transit center from its present location, and in fact, will put it underground. Where will it be?
Well, we think that if you've been in some of the larger communities, the buses do go down a ramp and mm-hmm. underground, and that is really in kind of like building your roof, and so that you can get best use of the property above that. So the dirt is worth a lot, but having that safe ability to come tunnel through and drive in and out and protect the transit riders is really an important one.
But where will it be?
Well, it will be on the site. we're looking at that same site, but we're looking at how to design it differently. I'm sorry, I didn't catch where you were exactly going, but yes, that site.
Yeah, we're having a little problem. You're having a problem hearing me, and we know that, and I'm sorry about that. There's nothing we can do about that. North Carolina is scheduled, the state is scheduled to receive, I think, $7.2 billion over the next 5 years from these federal funds. Who decides where in North Carolina that money will go and to which projects?
So I'm going to take a stab at this and say that there are going to be allocations to, just like we got some funding for when we started out with COVID, some of it goes to the state and the state makes the decisions on where it goes. But often because of the size of our city, there may be some direct city allocations. If you'll recall, some of the, when we were doing the CARES funding, we got our own amount of a grant. Like other cities, it was cities over 500,000 people had that. In terms of where we're going with transportation, we pretty much compete with the Texas cities, Austin, Houston, and Dallas. Charlotte would be probably and likely the only city in North Carolina that would qualify if they make an allocation specifically for urban areas.
But does somebody in North Carolina make the decision, or is that the decision being made at the federal level?
The decision on urban areas receiving separate allocations is from the federal government, usually.
And do we have, I know that you're a Democrat, and Democrats are hoping that the funneling of some of this money will make itself known to the public at large in advance of the midterms. And that's only possible if we have projects that are shovel ready. And as soon as the money arrives, they begin and signs go up to say, this is the money that we gave you. So vote for us, essentially. Do we have that's what you're going to do with it if you're smart. Do we have any projects that are shovel ready to go as soon as the money arrives?
I think a couple of things that we could really see move very quickly is the allocation towards purchasing more electric buses, the ability to plan more bus routes and more reliable times for our buses. That's something that we can do very, very quickly. We, as you said, we have plans for how do we reconstruct our transit stop there at across the street from the Spectrum Arena. That's not shovel ready, but the planning and design of it and the thinking is there. So it just depends. I think that when we say shovel ready, there are degrees of that. Across the country, some people may just have it in their strategic plan. Right. What we're trying to do is make sure that we have the money by having hopefully the opportunity to grow our transit investment with the sales tax at some point, that we would have the money to make these projects come about more quickly than not.
So according to NCDOT, we have about 3,000 miles of highways that are in poor condition. So the state can use that money. Charlotte has its own challenges with the road repair and upkeep. Both Republican United States Senators, Richard Burr and Tom Tillis, voted for this infrastructure package that the vice president was talking about when she was here last week. But not a single Republican member of the House, including those from Charlotte, voted for it. How do you explain that? State needs the money. Charlotte needs the money. How do you explain it?
I want to just publicly acknowledge a grateful thank you to both of our senators for recognizing sometimes you have to rise above this. You know, at this point, infrastructure doesn't have a D or an R behind it. It's just not that.
How do you explain the obstruction in the House?
Well, I can't explain what people always think about or their philosophies. I can only own what I have as a philosophy. And my philosophy is that we're trying to always attract the most opportunities that we have for the residents of this community. And that's where I think perhaps as a senator, you have more of an idea nationally or even in your own state, how you can adjust for that. So I think Senator Tillis and Senator Burr were really very helpful in this, and we appreciated that.
Yesterday, in a conversation we were having with the Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iseult and others on this program, we were talking about the Charlotte Vision Zero goal of reducing traffic fatalities in the city. And this is an international goal, but our goal is 2030 to reduce them to zero. And in the course of that program, we learned that since the year 2000, CDOT, Charlotte Department of Transportation, has finished 38 street retrofit projects designed to improve safety. And at that rate of construction and refitting, if you do the math, retrofitting just 300 of the 2,528 miles of Charlotte roads would take until the year 2321. I don't think you'll still be in office, but it's a question not only of...
I might not only be in office, I may not be around to drive on the road. So.
I would say you will not in 2321. But it's not just money, it's time and priorities. What do you see as our priorities when it comes to roads and transit?
That's a really good question, because when you're in serving this community, the city council, myself, even the staff, I think what we try to do is always make progressive steps on any goal that we have. And that means setting priorities. So I think as long as we have a criteria that the public will accept in terms of what is the highest priority, where are we most unsafe, where are we seeing these things happen more frequently than not, and we address those in that respect. So it's never one of those things that we've never, in my time here in Charlotte as both a staffer and as a council member and mayor, had the ability to say, we're going to do something all in the next 5 years. Our 300 square miles, lots of road miles to go. But I believe that the community understands we will go where the highest and greatest need and impact can be made.
When the vice president was here last Friday, and she also spoke about the president's Build Back Better bill, which has been stuck and continues to be stuck in Congress. It's stuck now in the Senate, being held up by two Democrats, and it will take all of the Democrats in the Senate voting yes to make this pass. Most Americans don't know what's in this bill, as we've been told time and time again, because the press, the media, and the Democrats keep talking about the struggle to get it there as opposed to what's in the bill. But when you present individual Americans with the individual ideas and policy points in the bill, they are in favor of them by and large, and that includes Republicans. The Democrats haven't sold this, and time is running out. Do you know what's in this Build Back Better bill and how it might favorably impact the lives of people here?
There are two things that I've been tracking in the bill, and the first one is the child care. In our community, we need workforce talent, and if you lock men and women out of the ability to have a job because they can't find adequate childcare for their kids, we're making a huge state mistake, not just here in Charlotte, but nationally. So I know that the childcare issue, whether it is in the idea of tax credits or supplements, however it's done, is one of those issues that's important to us because we need workforce talent. We want women to participate in this. And the second thing that I think has been an issue is the idea of leave of absence for parental leave as well as elder care. When you look at our demographics, we're lucky if we have grandparents and elders that are self-sufficient. But when that time comes that they're not, sometimes a family member is the only way to do that if you don't have wealth. And I think those two areas are basically around helping people through a time that they're needed. Child care at the beginning and elder care at the end. And I would hope that both of those would be included in a way that's significant to help us in our community's growth.
Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles, our guest for the hour. We will be coming back to talk about some of the companies coming to town and what that means for our economy and employment. And we'll take a look back on some of the challenges and accomplishments of 2021 as well. And when we continue on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is with us. She joins us about once a month to talk about various different things. We heard on Monday that Toyota is building a multi-billion-dollar factory to produce batteries for the electric cars that they will be building in this decade. It won't be located here, unfortunately, because it's a major factory and it's a major employment opportunity. But Arrival EV, another electric car battery manufacturer, is coming. They're adding a fourth facility to Charlotte to produce high-voltage batteries and bringing 150 jobs to town. What else can you tell us about them and that project? Mayor Lyles, you're muted. We can't hear you. There we go.
All right, so I just wanted to say that I had the opportunity to have lunch with Mike Abelson with Arrival. He's the CEO. And this was at the very beginning when they were just beginning to staff up for the facility on the west side. And we were talking about how they could get employees from that part of our region and that part of our city. And he was just basically saying that if things go well, if we're really serious about electronic vehicles, then Arrival is going to be a key part of this manufacturing opportunity. And I believe that that's what you're seeing here. They have located a factory or already for selling or making vans for delivery the delivery industry. And to go to this place on the battery side is another recommitment to, we have people ready to work. We have places that they can build. And those are the things that are keeping our city growing and a part of what I would believe the new economy is going to be as we try to address making sure that our climate change is different and makes a difference.
And this company, Arrival EV, announced a little while ago that it was moving its North American headquarters to Charlotte. Has that happened yet?
I don't believe it has happened yet. I haven't cut a ribbon, so I'm hopeful that when we do get them, I will be invited. So well, I can't answer that, Mike. I want to cut the ribbon, though. So if Mike is listening to this, then we are going to say, where's my invite?
You know. All right. So you and Governor Roy Cooper did cut a ribbon this week for Honeywell's and their new headquarters, their new 23-story tower on South Mint Street. Honeywell says moving here was, quote, one of the best decisions they've ever made. Is that because of the $87 million worth of state and local tax incentives, or is there more to it than that?
I think that there's a lot more to it. Honeywell came and they said they'd have 1,000 employees. They opened their building with 1,300 or more. When you go into that building, and I wish every kid that is thinking about how they might participate in what decisions they're going to make about a college or whatever, when you go into that building and see aeronautics, you see the idea of electrical, all of the HVAC systems and everything that's going on. Honeywell, having that Fortune 100 company here brings innovation that we would not have gotten. Think about the opportunities for people that are engineering or at North Carolina State or North Carolina A&T. They actually have programs that directly recruit from both of those schools. They're helping us build a place of excellence for the types of industries that they serve. Aeronautics, as I said, HVAC, electrical, all of those things. And there, I want to connect these two things. They are a major healthcare provider in terms of how hospitals and medical schools are designed. And I believe that there's a lot of synergy that can be taken here. But Honeywell is not just, it's a group of industries pulled together. And we're just fortunate enough that they chose us as a headquarter city.
So let's look, spend some time, not a lot, but let's look back on some of the challenges and some of the accomplishments that you and City Council dealt with in 2021. And let's start with the Charlotte Future 2040 Comprehensive Plan. It was an arduous journey toward that plan's passage. It all boiled down really to one small, tiny portion of the plan that dealt with allowing multifamily units, duplexes, triplexes, quadruplexes, in areas that have traditionally been single-family neighborhoods. The nicer parts of the debate on council included comments like these from Republican Tariq Bakari and Democrat Malcolm Graham.
Unfortunately, Charlotte's going to become all the bad parts of living in Atlanta.
I'll be the first to say it's not perfect. It's not a perfect plan, but it moves us forward.
Those were the nice parts of the debate. It was often rancorous, and you actually ended a meeting early because it became increasingly testy and personal, and the plan ultimately passed by one vote. Did all this resistance and the declining of the verbal dialogue, if that's a way to put it, surprise you?
Oh, Mike, I think that we are seeing across this country a strategy of divisiveness. I think that oftentimes people cast their positions as such extremes that you can't figure out where you are in the middle. As mayor of this city, I believe that we have to serve everyone. And as people are coming, if you have an option or an alternative that's better than what the professional team is putting on the table, let's talk about that. Let's not disparage any one effort because we disagree with it. Let's figure out where that disagreement occurs and what you would do to change it. And I think the real question was, everyone wants to see this growth. We just talked about roads. We just talked about transit. With that, all that infrastructure, if we're going to have the growth that we have, then how are we going to move people around and provide them shelter? I don't want to be the city that has to create a bus system to bring workers in. Often that's happening in San Francisco with the private sector. They're creating their own transportation systems. Transportation should be a public good. And so when we talk about the 2040 plan, I think that we have learned a lot. I think we have to give greater voices to the people in this community, the people that really care about things like community benefit, people that care about too much regulation, people that care about density. And we're working through that. We're in the middle of our mapping process right now and drafting of the UDO. Julie Isold is the chair of our committee that is dealing with both of these issues. And we have these really great conversations about how to track this and keep the community engaged in it. We've appointed two commissions, an infrastructure commission and a displacement commission, to say, help us with the ideas that we didn't think about now. And as we go on, continue this journey, we need to accept the recommendations that we have that would help us do this successfully. And that's what's really important.
So are you saying that council should not question the staff and their recommendations?
Absolutely not. I'm saying that they ought to challenge the staff and say, here's what I want to accomplish and how do I do that? But okay. Just to say, I don't want what you have without giving staff some guidance on what to get. I mean, this is a big business that we're talking about.
And if you recall, during the course of these deliberations, one of the complaints by many people on council was that the staff allegedly wasn't listening to them. They weren't incorporating their ideas into this plan. Do you think that was a valid criticism in hindsight?
I don't question people's intent. I think if you said that, it was very valid. Whether or not it was as accurate or was there an attempt to correct that, I think both of those things would apply. We needed to check the accuracy, and when accurate, we needed to adjust. Or the staff needed to adjust.
We haven't heard much about this plan since its passage. There was a big brouhaha, then it passed, and then everybody fell silent. We may start hearing about it because the city, evidently city council, is now drafting maps for the plan. I thought those maps were already drafted. What are they doing?
Okay, so some of us have been around long enough to know that when the last time we did a comprehensive rezoning, there were places that they never got a chance to define, so they just slapped a label on them. I use Scotland Avenue as an example. It's all zone multifamily 22, meaning you could build 22 units per acre, and every place along there is a bungalow. Mm-hmm. And they just did it because there was a deadline. What we're trying to do is to work out where we actually define the zoning districts, neighborhood services, community services, transit oriented, all of that together. And so that we get this done in a way. So this week, Several members of the council came to join in a policy map process that hundreds of people have done that live in the community. And neighborhoods that sent their neighborhood boards, their community neighborhood leaders there, they actually came together and they looked at every parcel and talked about which zoning district under the 2040 plan would be available for them. And that's really residential, retail, and industrial permitting. And we get to talk about how you want to see the things designed and what you want your neighborhood to feel and look like. I think the strength of Charlotte is to make sure that we maintain our culture and to maintain our history as much as we can. And I know how hard that is with change coming up, but that's what our neighborhoods are talking about, the idea of infrastructure.
Are these conversations part of the beginning of the conversation about the Unified Development Ordinance, which I believe is underway, the development of which is underway, and these are the rules that will govern the plan that's already been approved? Are these conversations a part of that?
The UDO is the rule book.
Right.
The mapping is the designation of what type of development will be allowed on the ground. And then you take the rule book and say, well, the rules are, if you want to change this or if you want to do something different, what are the exceptions to the rules? What are the rules that you must follow? What do we do about a number of things to make, and when we talk about maintaining our culture and maintaining our history, how do you do that? How do you make sure that neighborhoods are built safely, sidewalks and development occurs? So rules as well as designation of how the what development can occur there.
Speaking of ordinances, 2021 was also the year that Charlotte City Council voted unanimously to amend the city's non-discrimination ordinance to include familial status, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, veteran status, pregnancy, and natural hairstyles as classes protected against discrimination. They took effect October the 1st. Several years after the city's first attempt was knocked down by the legislature and their ill-fated HB 2. So far, so good?
So far, so good. And I want to say to this community and every resident living here, the council decided that we would be a place that accepted diversity and we would be welcoming. And a unanimous vote by the Charlotte City Council on this non-discrimination ordinance, followed by an adoption of real penalties that could be enforced and investigated in a way that the communities agreed upon, was exceptional. It's one of the highlights of our actions and work this year.
City leaders have called this vote historic, and you have said it was the right thing to do. In fact, after the vote, you told this to the media.
These kinds of ordinances reflect what the practices are across this country right now, not for everyone, but appropriately for our community.
What did that mean? Not for everyone, but for our community.
Well, I don't recall what I meant by that. I mean, if I'm really honest, and I'm at this point, I guess, in my life where I say, sometimes it's just like, it just seemed to flow that way. But what I really think it meant, I joke about this, but what I meant was that, you know, not everybody's going to agree on everything, but we do what we believe best for all. We do what we believe is something that reflects our values. And so that's really what I think. And I'm really looking forward to the Pride Parade and celebration coming back next year. I hope this COVID pandemic turns into an endemic and we begin to celebrate all of our diversity in our community. In so many ways, we've missed that. I miss those parades. I miss the celebrations, the time to be together, to hug someone and say thank you for what you've done. So hopefully we get better.
A couple final questions about the non-discrimination ordinance. Has it been used by anyone yet who feels they have been discriminated against? And because this applies to all businesses in Charlotte, has there been any negative fallout since that went into effect in October?
Mike, I'm not aware of any negative fallout or if there has been any complaints. So let me, maybe can I get that back to
sure.
you? I'll check with the staff and community relations. And if there is something, we'll get back to you that you
okay.
can make sure your listeners know.
Voter maps are being redrawn at all levels, we all know, because of the 2020 census. And there has been trouble at all levels because of the redrawing of these maps. There's with regard to city council, There is a lawsuit pending involving the Hidden Valley neighborhood. Those bringing the suit believe that moving some black voters from one precinct and moving that precinct into a district that has voted predominantly for white candidates will dilute the black vote. And former city attorney Mac McCarley, who helped draw the maps, says he believes that the move actually improves black candidates' chances in this new district. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think that the council members that served on that committee did an outstanding job because there had to be change. I mean, you can see where the growth is occurring. We were out of sync with the requirements for equal one vote, one person, one vote. And so the changes had to be made, and they came down to some very specific, difficult decisions to be made. And actually, I believe Councilmember Watlington actually read something that was based in what Mac McCarley said, that if you look at the minority black and brown population in District 1, it is a winnable district, or at least one that will be very competitive. And I would hope that people don't get put off by the idea that if you're in a district, you can file this month to run in that district, even if you have changed and your precinct has moved.
Well, the primary is in March. Will these lawsuits be settled by March, or if they're still in process and candidates file and declare and begin running for the November election, could all of that apple cart be upset by a decision at the court level?
You know, my understanding is that locally for Charlotte, that we'll be able to go ahead and file as well as plan for a March primary. I think the difficulty is at the state level, where if there is a runoff or if there has to be some change, that I don't know the answer. When right now it was March, and then there would be for the primary, and then there would be an April election. But even then, they had two dates for it. And the two dates were built around whether or not there was going to be a runoff at any statewide election. So it's getting it right. This year was difficult because the census was never really done and executed in the way that it should have been. We'll have to just wait and see. Next year will be better.
Okay. I don't have a lot of time in this segment, but building our stock of affordable housing has been one of your major thrusts during your time in office. And in September, City Council approved $23.3 million from the city's Housing Trust Fund to help finance 9 affordable housing developments. That could add as many as 879 affordable units for families and seniors. Will this make a dent? Because the need is much bigger than that, and I have 10 seconds.
The need is much bigger. We've done over 4,600 units, including those. But we're also trying to make sure that we don't have people evicted. And that's just as important as building, is keeping them in adequate housing.
We'll talk some more about that and other issues when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mayor Vial Isles is with us for her regularly scheduled visit to talk a little bit more about affordable housing before we move on, because since 2002, the city has spent more than $177 million on affordable housing. The price of all housing in Charlotte has skyrocketed, including the price of rentals. Rental prices have climbed 45%. Since 2010, and the pandemic added extra hardship to those least economically positioned to weather the storm. Are we moving forward, or are we standing still, or are we moving backward in our effort to find affordable housing?
Okay, Mike, first let me say that we are never going to move backward, because backward would be where we didn't do anything. And this community has approved and adopted policies and funding to move an affordable housing in a very strong way. In fact, I have to, if you don't mind, I'm just going to say Pam Wyman, who is leading this effort as a staff person with us, she's retiring in January, and she has led this program for, you know, so many years. In 2018, you know, she has actually taken us so far. She's a national speaker and awards given many, many times. So we're not moving backwards. We're moving very much forward. This community has made this commitment, and it's exceptional. I just have to say that, you know, over the result of Pam's leadership, almost $50 million in rental, mortgage, utility, and deposit assistance. We've been, with this COVID, over 17,000 households financially impacted by COVID have remained in their homes. That's the kind of thing that we're doing. And if we can do this until the economy recovers and the workforce is back and those jobs can come back, we would have saved, instead of saying we need have a greater need, maybe those 17,000 will never have to be homeless to go through that process. Because once you're homeless, once you have an eviction on your record, it is so difficult to come back. And we're trying to prevent that. But we're also, as I said, over 4,600 units of new construction. And we are putting a lot of investment into buying apartment complexes that are available, that we can keep people that are working, just our minimum wage or under $15 an hour workers, available, or having them have housing opportunities. So I want to just say that Pam Whiteman is a rock star. She's someone that cares deeply, but also acts with expediency and creativity and innovation, and we're going to miss her a lot.
So the last time you were here, you had just announced the Mayor's Racial Equity Initiative and the fact that more than $195 million had been raised toward the goal of $250 million by a variety of community entities, including businesses and the city and others. This is the largest investment in the city's history to address racial disparities. You called it a defining moment, but these inequities have been with us in this city and in this country for centuries. I'm not exaggerating. Given the depth of the problem and the impact this problem has on society at large, how much real benefit do you think can come from $250 million?
Well, I think that one of the things is that we weren't trying to solve every problem. In fact, there are many people, and I point to several groups that are working on the idea of racial equity. This was just working with the corporate leadership to say, what can you do? And I believe that they have stepped up, and the investment alone in Johnson C. Smith University will change the lives of every student that comes through that university. The idea that they are going to transform it, you know, Johnson C. Smith is our only HBCU here in Charlotte, and they were having a really tough time, like all HBCUs that are not state supported, keeping students during COVID. The idea of losing a freshman class for a full year and maybe even having fewer students apply as a result of COVID, and gave them an opportunity. They took something that was, I think, a real issue and said, what do we do that's going to be different? And partnering with the private sector is an exceptional effort on the behalf of that board of trustees. So when you think about having the idea of focusing on business curriculum, data analytics, medical and healthcare services, all of those are curriculums that they did not have that they're going to create. And the private sector contributed that money, $80 million total, to Johnson C. Smith to transform that university and therefore transform the lives of African-American, Black and brown kids that attend that university.
There was a little dust up recently on council and elsewhere over the $10 million of federal COVID relief that, unbeknownst, according to the council, unbeknownst to them, ended up in the $250 million Mayor's Racial Equity Initiative. I believe that you promised that $10 million would be used to bridge the digital divide, a decision some on council felt blindsided by. What happened there?
So let me say, I listened to your roundup on Friday, driving back from Durham, and I heard people say that this $10 million was in the mayor's racial equity fund. And I think that it's really clear that there was a distinction there, and perhaps one that I didn't make clear enough. The city council had been working on digital divide since we put those hotspots out with COVID and having to react to the pandemic. And we realized, and you talked about this on your educational show, the loss of learning in Title I schools, primarily Black and brown students, was almost a year of loss. And we looked at, as a council, during the CARES money, we put those hotspots out. Now with ARPA money, we're talking about providing internet access. And the private sector said we will provide the equipment, the hardware that they need for these households to be successful in having their children participate in the digital world. I believe that the one of the executives at Bank of America said, a parent cannot apply to work at Bank of America if they don't have online access. They don't accept paper applications. So the $10 million that was being discussed is not going in. It was representative of our commitment to this community to eliminate the digital divide. The city council still has, like we have, approved that ARPA's money. That money comes through. I'd like to see collaboration and coordination on how we do this. I'd love to see how the county and the school system and the private sector can solve a problem that is much greater than any conversation about $10 million.
So that would be your response to the North Carolina Republican U.S. Representative Ted Budd, who's running for Richard Burr's seat in the Senate. He's asked for details about whether the $10 million will be used for COVID relief. And your argument is that given what happened during COVID, because of the digital divide, this money being put toward closing that gap is COVID relief money.
And actually, we did reply and send a letter to the senator's office thanking him for the inquiry, because I think
he's not a senator yet.
That's true. He's not a senator yet. The congressman that's running for Senate asked that question, and we replied to him, and we basically said, here are the rules of engagement that we got from the federal government, and we complied with it. But we also went further to say, this is what we believe is the best option for use of this money. When you think about the CARES Act money, which we've almost spent all of it, we had the percentages that we actually said we were going to push this money out into the community. The difference between the CARES, we were reacting so quickly, you know, grants so that small businesses could, you know, keep their doors open, you know, closing the streets so that restaurants could serve outdoors. With the ARPA's money, we have the time and ability to design something that really works, that's more permanent and keeps us safer from the next pandemic. And I hope it never happens. So, but it does keep us prepared and safe.
So since the
and
council,
digital divide is one of them.
So since the council felt blindsided by this, are you saying that if they were blindsided, it was because you didn't communicate it properly? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yes, I don't think, I probably assume because we had done this and invested in it, that we all understood that this investment wasn't over yet. And I did not explain it well, and sometimes that just happens.
And then Jay emails, and I'm not sure how this fits into this topic that we've been talking about, but he emails, why did the mayor take federal COVID money meant for people of all backgrounds and repurpose it toward projects like making JCSU a top HBCU? Both JCSU and Queens are private institutions with sky-high tuition. Wouldn't that money make more of an impact going to low-income students at CPCC?
That is a great question, because none of the federal dollars went into the Johnson C. Smith program. Queens has a different issue because they are actually where the community made a decision to coordinate digital divide efforts. It was at the library, now at Queens. They have an institute there for coordination of digital divide. And that is what they are already funded with that. It's the idea of how do we do collaboration with them, but there is not federal money going to Queens for that purpose from this ARPA's funding. So thanks for that question, because I've been budget and finance, all of that stuff. It's hard to keep up with every source of every income stream that we have sometimes to implement some of these programs. But I want the community to know that we believe the investment of this federal money was not about keeping the money to drive it in a certain direction, except with two things. One, to make sure our employees were safe, particularly those that are frontline employees, make sure that they had equipment that protected them, to make sure that they could come to work and continue to feel safe and do the work that's necessary. And then we wanted the community to be engaged, and we wanted that money to support people that were having very difficult times during this pandemic. And I think we've achieved both of that for CARES, and I hope that we'll continue to do that with the ARPA's funding.
There was a recent report that Myers Park Country Club was considering offering you a free honorary membership, according to a photograph taken of a computer screen on an internal website. They have a spy at Myers Park Country Club. According to that photograph, you are at the top of the list of proposed members. But you have now said that you are not interested. But didn't you apply for that membership?
I did apply, and I was nominated and for an honorary membership. And I have
did you
to
apply?
Say that as,
excuse me, did you apply for an honorary membership,
yes,
or did you apply
yes.
to be a member? Okay.
I applied for an honorary membership. And as I learned about the process, and I have to say, I wasn't even aware of the website. The club has not communicated with me directly. They may have in other cases, I'm not sure. But once I found out that was available, I went to the city attorney, talked about what it was, and he said under our ethics rules, and I have asked for my application to be withdrawn, and I will no longer be considered for the club.
So let me ask you this, because the media is complaining, other members of the media are complaining they can't get a straight answer about this. You applied for an honorary membership. When you did that, were you aware that that honorary membership meant that they would be waiving their $95,000 entry fee?
I was aware that there was a cost to the club. I was not aware until they come back and say, this is what it is. I was not really thinking that I had any obligation. And if there was an obligation on my part, they have not explained that to me. And I don't know the details of it, but I would say to you that including the potential of being waived or deferred was an idea that I had in the back of my mind. I knew that.
This
and
actually,
so checking on it.
This actually surprises and confuses me, because to be up front and center about this, several years ago when you did a special video for our production of Charlotte Squawks, I offered you free tickets to the show in return for you doing the video. And you said, I'd love to come see it, but I can't accept the free tickets. I'll have to pay for them because of our ethics rules. Those tickets were probably $65 each. that's a far cry from $95,000. How could you make that mistake?
I think the difference was I did not know what honorary really meant. I just did not know. I thought it was an honorary. It didn't mean that I wouldn't have to pay for it, but I did not know. And honestly, with the application this summer, I have not seen anything since I sent in the application until this was brought up by the media. And in a way, I owe them a lot of appreciation for it.
Okay. Just wanted to get that out there in the open and explained. Clearly, you like this job. I don't know why anybody likes a job in government, but because it's you can't do anything right. But you're running for re-election, and this will be, I think, your third term after two terms as mayor, two terms on council, and working as a staff member within city government. What is it about this job that you like?
You know, Mike, I've always said this. I have a tangible love for the city. I came here to go to college. I came back, raised my family here. I just see Charlotte as one of those special places. Not necessarily, I can't define special sometimes, but for me, to have the opportunities that I had in this city, a young girl from South Carolina going to Queens, that was at the time unheard of. I'm just really the idea that, you know, I remember when I was a staffer, the first time I met Hugh McCall, I was in my 20s and I was working for the city of Charlotte, and I got to meet someone that was head of Nations Bank. It's a special place because of the relationships that we form. And we're not perfect by any means. But you just look around, and Richard Venroot just recently sent me a note, and basically he was just saying, sometimes when people talk about our city and they're like, this is wrong, this is not right, and we make mistakes. And he says, but look at what good we have accomplished and what we're doing. And I am so appreciative for the leadership in the past. And I just hope that one day someone will be mayor, and I'll be able to write a letter just like Richard wrote to me to say, you know, look at this always as the big picture, because this is a great place to live.
Just a reminder to folks who haven't been here long, Richard Vinroot is a former mayor and a Republican, and you are a Democrat. Yes. Thank you for the hour,
and
Mayor.
A good friend.
Thank you, Mayor Lyles, for the hour, and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to everyone.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.